Hello, everyone, and welcome to Power Prospecting, Finding Your Major Gift Opportunities, a topic that is on all of our minds all the time. I'm Brian Saber, president of Asking Matters. We're delighted to have a massive group of you today, which only underscores how important this topic continues to be. Where are those prospects? How do we find them? How do we rate them? I'm delighted to have Jay with us here today. I'm going to introduce him in a minute. I'm just going to do some quick housekeeping before that. Hopefully, on the left, you're seeing a slide, and on the right, a control panel. If not, click on that white and orange arrow to expand it. Two things you'll want to watch for there. The first is audio. Most of us listen today over our computers with a headset or through speakers. If you're having any issues, toggle to phone call and dial in. Usually it's on your end, and that will clear it up for you. The second is the questions box. We encourage your questions. We got some questions from members in advance. We will absolutely get to those. We'll try to get to yours. We have over 500 people registered for today. So get that question in early if you want to ask, if you want to ask it. And Jay might be asking you some questions along the way. And just so I know that you know where that questions box is, if you could type in where you're listening from today, that would be great. I am speaking to you today from South Orange, New Jersey, where I live and work. And you're all typing in, and we've got people, as we expect, from all over the country, from Virginia, Florida, New York, Maryland, Wisconsin, down in New Orleans. Great. I was just there twice, Holly, in the last 2 weeks. Wonderful to have you all here. Reminder, for those of you who've been with us before, know you will get a link to the recording of this webinar probably tomorrow with a copy of Jay's slide. So we really appreciate that. And now, without further ado, I want to introduce Jay and turn this over to him. So it's funny, on his LinkedIn page, he calls himself a speaker, a trainer, and a fundraising Sherpa. And as soon as I give you the rest of his bio, I'm going to ask him to explain what he means by fundraising Sherpa. I love that line. But I do want you to know he's currently, he's a senior partner with Gerald Panis, Lindsay & Partners. And I know all of you know who Jerry Panis is, and we've had him on our program here. He's an associate at the Resource Alliance, which is a British-based consulting company. And he's the Flash Class host and an advisor for Donor Search. And I'm sure some of you have been on have listened in on webinars there, and Jay organizes all of that. He has a deep history in this field. He was president and CEO of Wealth ID. He was chief strategy officer of Wealth Engine. This guy knows as much about prospecting and databases and research as anyone in the field. He's also one of the nicest people in the field. He's one of the people I have enjoyed getting to know the best over these years. And so it is my delight, Jay, to welcome you, pass the torch to you. And I'm going to change presenters so you can start. Jay.
Thank you so much, Brian. Really appreciate it. And yes, I just came down from the Himalayas, so I'll be telling you all about that. The fundraising Sherpa piece is something that, I'll give credit where credit is due, because all of us learned from somebody before. And so among the many people I've learned from was someone, Ron DeLandria, who he probably doesn't know he taught me this either, but he was the head of development at the University of Toronto before he went on to lead the shop at Oxford, and he's been many other places. It's been a big force in philanthropy, but he did a presentation for a case conference, must be 25 years ago. My wife and I both attended and we spoke, but he was definitely the featured presenter, and he talked about these fundraising Sherpas. He talked about how we needed Sherpa guides. And I thought that was just such a great way of explaining that you can be really good at what you do, whether you're new to the profession or you've been in it a long time, but we all need somebody as our partner to make it up to the summit. And so that's the hope behind being a fundraising Sherpa, is just to work with other really great colleagues, some of whom might know a lot more than me at any given point in time, but inevitably it's good to have a coach or a guide or a partner to make the summit. So hopefully that's a good explanation, Brian.
Yeah, that is. I like that. I like that a lot. Thank you.
Anyway, it's really great to be with you, and I can jump right in, and then I will try to, as you were saying, keep an eye on the questions tab I guess is probably the best place. And thank you, everybody, for telling me where you're from. I have to admit that there's one person from Barbados, and that's the thing I really clung to, because that sounds like a great place to be. But it's really great to know that you're all here from all these places, and hopefully what I have to share with you will be relevant wherever you are. If it is not, if there's something that's particular to your part of the world and you don't find it covered here, I hope you'll ask about it. And if we don't get a chance to answer it during our hour together, then of course I'll be happy to talk with you offline as well. So with that, maybe I can jump right in. And then I'm going to show you a picture. And this is a picture, obviously, of a couple of ugly smokestacks somewhere. Once upon a time in fundraising, I'm told by many of the people that kind of predate me in this profession, even though I'm now in my 50s, is that you could look for where the industry was, maybe literally where the smokestacks were, and find where the money was. And I don't know if that's true where you are, but it's more likely that maybe you'd see something like this. Does anybody recognize where this is? Go ahead and put something in the question box if you recognize this place. This is the first quiz item today. So we're going to see if anybody can answer. And if not, by the way, you're not only not alone on this call, but among most people would not recognize it. So I see a big nope here. A library, in a sense, it's definitely in California. And I'll just keep that up there for a minute. My mouse is not cooperating, but I'm sure there are other answers. Oh, wow. Microsoft, Google. There we go. We have a winner. Apple. The Apple headquarters, Eleanor. Thank you for that. So anyway, the reason I put this up there, except for those of you who actually recognize what Apple looks like at a distance, that's pretty impressive, is because I know this is a nice building, but I don't look at this building and think this is where all the money is. Only when I hear it's Apple and I know the market cap do I think that. Similarly, if we were to go and look at a building like this, and I know it's a little blurry, but does anybody recognize this rather handsome house?
I do, I think.
Okay.
Can I guess?
Go ahead.
Is it the Breakers?
It is.
Newport?
Okay. So for those who don't know, yes, and we've got other people saying the Breakers. So obviously some of you have been to Newport, Rhode Island. And this is a pretty big, handsome house. Of course, these were these summer homes, the summer cottages. Actually, is how they were described. So, that doesn't look like a cottage to me. But once upon a time, that's where some of the rich lived. And of course, you knew they were rich. If you got close enough to the house to see it, you'd know that they were. What about this house? Nobody on this call recognizes this house.
I do.
I mean, it's virtually impossible. You do not.
I do. I do. But I'll first admit that I thought the first one was from Grey's Anatomy. So, I'm not running 100% here. But I think I do just because of the context. But let's see. Someone said your house, but I think we have a couple who actually got it. If you look at Marty and Stephanie and Jess, are they right?
No.
It's not Warren Buffett's house.
It's not a famous house at all, actually.
Okay.
This is a current house in Cupertino, California. And it's a little bigger than it looks, which is to say it's about 3,000 square feet. It's broken up now into apartments. It does have a three-car garage in back, I think. But this is just a house in Cupertino, California. Now, probably some of you are tuned into what that means. And you may as well say it's Warren Buffett's or Steve Jobs' original house anyway. Because this house now is on the market for $3 million. Mm. And my real point in that is that if you drove by this house and you didn't happen to think it was Warren Buffett's house or something, somebody famous's house, you might look at it and say, well, that's not much of a house. If you noticed it at all, you certainly wouldn't want to live there, especially with a lot of roommates. But the real point is that you can't judge this book by its cover. And similarly, last of these little images here, some of you may recognize the gent in the middle who looks like Santa. If you do, go ahead and put that in. This is the final quiz from these little photos. Yes, Kate has it, Carnegie. Now, the only real question is it Carnegie or Carnegie? And I still can't figure that out. But I'll just call him Carnegie because it's easy. And Andrew Carnegie, of course, we know is the man who was so philanthropic and so dedicated to taking his massive resources and giving them away at his death and before. Building libraries, actually also an early investor in the movement for peace. And there's a great story about Carnegie and and Teddy Roosevelt, trying to get him to act as an advocate for that effort to avoid World War I. But the real reason I'm putting the picture here is because even if you didn't know it was Carnegie, and even if you didn't know any of that, you'd probably know from this picture that that guy had a lot of money. But what about this guy? Now, Brian, if you know this guy, don't answer it. But I want to see if anybody else possibly recognizes anyone remotely famous in this picture. And this is a hard one. I expected it to be. Okay, so first of all, I'll give you a clue. It's the guy in the really loud shirt. Yes, I know that there are several loud shirts there. But anyway, I've been told by folks in Hawaii that that is not a Hawaiian shirt, first of all. And maybe what explains that is the person in Connecticut wearing what they would think to be a Hawaiian shirt. But that man in the Hawaiian shirt is Ray Dalio. And if you don't recognize that name, he is a pretty big hedge fund guy. He lives in Greenwich, Connecticut. That's where his firm is. He is, I believe, 62nd richest person in the world, 26th in America. So, of course, I'm making a very obvious point, which is that if you were walked by him in the street, you would not recognize him as a Carnegie of our times. And I'm not comparing them in terms of their philanthropy, but merely their wealth in the world. And it's not quite Carnegie's, but it's rather extraordinary. And you really can't judge those things in the way I think many of us have traditionally, by looking at our databases, finding out where the money might be on the basis of a zip code or what they've given to us or these other kinds of indicators that we've often used because we needed something to get us started. So what I'm hoping to do today with you for a little bit is to show some of the kind of clues and indicators that you can find in various places, starting with, of course, that little pond of your own database or spreadsheet, whatever you've got, working your way out kind of in circles, like a rock dropped into a pond, where those then the ripples go out further and further to other concentric circles of individuals touched by either your organization or by the people who know and love it, and people you might be able to bring in a little closer if you could just find out where they are, who they are, and what they care about. And hopefully some will be like Ray Dalio. If we were to try to find a Ray Dalio in your database, he would definitely be at the top of this pyramid, which is not a campaign pyramid, but a pyramid. It's from, as you can see at the bottom of the slide, Credit Suisse, which is one of several companies that produces tremendous wealth information, all of which is for free. And so this is the Credit Suisse Global Wealth Data Book from 2017, where this image is derived from. And you can see at the top, these are individuals with $50 million U.S. I mean, everything I'm going to talk about today is in U.S. dollars. $50 million in investable assets, or in other words, exclusive of their primary residence or any debt. So this is their investable assets. And if you looked at all the people with over $50 million in the world, Credit Suisse counts that number at about 148,000 people. So that's it. And so if you wanted somebody to give you $1 million tomorrow, they'd probably have to come from at least the green and the yellow area of this pyramid. Everybody else, we love them and they can help us in lots of ways. And I'm a big believer in opening the doors to them and understanding them and inviting their participation as well. But when it comes to the people who can make the really extraordinary transformational gifts that will change the life of your organization and help you advance the mission in a very dramatic way, it's at the very tippy top of this pyramid. And that's the entire market for us. No more than about 1.7 million people. Everybody else, again, is great, but we need to know where those people are. And I'm going to be talking mostly about the United States in the presentation today, largely because of time and where most of you are coming from. I can talk to some of the international issues offline. I'd be happy to do that. But I want to make one allusion to the rest of the world so it doesn't look like we're so insular and provincial that we think the U.S. is where everything happens, because it's not. And that is that, first of all, somewhere in the order of, I think it's 51% of the world's millionaires now are in the United States. That number changes as different things change in the economics of the world, as well as especially the stock market and currencies change value in relation to one another. If we had talked about this about 2 or 3 years ago, I would have said 75% of the world's wealth was outside the United States. What has happened, of course, is the stock market. And the stock market's exploded here. And, of course, things that rise do fall. So we can expect that to occur. But if you look at this in its totality, you also see another message here, which is that Europe, China, Asia Pacific, and other parts of the world are definitely places where a lot of wealth resides. So we're going to talk about the U.S., but I don't want to make it sound like this is the only place to look, because it's not. But in terms of research, it's much easier to focus on a place where we can get access to the information, we can read the information, and we can utilize the information pretty easily and efficiently and inexpensively. Now, I'm going to have several allusions to food, and it's not to make you hungry, but just to make sure there's some context for the people we talk about. And so the first thing I thought would be fun to do is to look at this pie. It is pie. This is from Pixabay, somebody's great picture of an apple pie. And I wanted to use this as context of, again, how much money is out there and who has how much. If we were to cut up this pie into the traditional 8 pieces and serve it to a table of 8, then fine, we all get a piece of pie. If we were to divide this into 100 pieces, and let's imagine it's a really big pie, and each piece goes to 1% of the U.S. population, then, of course, that would be equal distribution of pie. And there was something in the Washington Post that had a few slides I want to share with you quickly to give you an idea, again, a context about wealth, who has it and where it's grown the most and where we need to look. This is a picture of Pietopia, as Christopher Ingraham described it in the Post. And this is pulled from a lot of great data that they've done from the Noun Project. You can see that there. The pie icon is Teresa Behrens and other people. But the idea being that if we had 100 people representing each 1% of the population, each person got a piece of pie, we're all happy, we're all full, everything's good. But life is not like that. So what we've seen, and I know most of us know this, but I want to put it on the screen for us to just consider for a moment, is that the ultra wealthy now have more of the pie than they have, as the Washington Post conservatively estimates, at any point in the last 50 years. I would argue it may be back to the time of Carnegie, but we can discuss that another day. The main point is there's no question that the top 1% has so much more of the wealth creation, not just income creation, which is how the media usually describes it, but wealth. And this is most important to us because most gifts that come in terms of capital gifts, major gifts, planned gifts, as we all know, they do not come from income. That's what we're dealing with every day. If we make $100,000 a year or $1 million a year, we have to think about what our expenses are this week, this month. But our assets are an entirely different matter. We're giving that consideration in a different way. So the wealth creation is the thing we want to look at. Who owns that? How much has that grown? Where is it? This is an actual pie distribution, if you will. I just love these slides. Again, same source, Wonk blog at the Washington Post. And this looks at the top 20% and how they own 90 slices of pie. This is what we usually hear when people discuss wealth distribution in terms of politics and not philanthropy. But what I think is really interesting is this next slide. This is the top 1% in relation to everyone else. This is what's important to us. The top 1% owns 40% of the nation's wealth, not the income, but the wealth. 40 slices of that pie. The average net worth is $26.4 million. These are the people who are close to the top of that Credit Suisse pyramid. I'm trying to make this very real, because when we start talking about real people, we, of course, need to remember that they're human beings who put on their pants one leg at a time. But their situation is quite different. They're on this precarious post where they've got a lot of money, but just because they've been smart enough or lucky enough to make it does not mean they have a plan for how to utilize it. They're just as concerned about how their parents, their children, their grandchildren will feel about them as every one of us. And they also don't know what's going to happen to their money tomorrow, which is why it's important to not only think about them as a person with money, but as a person whose life is daily changing just like ours is. And so that's the top 1% that we're going to focus on for the next little bit. Everybody else is important. We love them all equally. But when it comes to making big things happen, these are the people who can do it. Now, what about who's giving? Well, I'm going to state, again, something that may be obvious to most of us, and especially because of the work that Giving USA has done, and that is that individuals, where the money supply is. So almost all of the content I'm going to share with you in the next few minutes is about individual people. And the reason is twofold. First, we know that 72% of money is coming from individuals. But we also know that the bequests, that 8%, which has grown, that's coming from individuals, right? So when people die, they pass it on. And then finally, these foundations, probably about half of that money, the 15%, is coming from things that we might consider loosely described as family foundations. This is something that we've created in order to perpetuate a legacy for our family and give our children something to do, to invest in the things that matter to us. So if you really count those numbers up, it's a lot closer to in the mid-80s or high 80s. So the corporate giving, the institutional foundation giving is really not significant in any way. And that's why we're going to focus on people. They have the money. They tend to give the money. The question is, do they know how to give it to us? Do they know we are here? And the answer, I think, to that last question is they don't. What I found consistently, and I'll touch on this at the very end, is that we only know about half of the people who have this kind of money in our databases, and only about half or less of those who might actually care about what we do. So it's our challenge, not the donors, to go out and find them, to find out what matters to them and to bring them into our universe. Not because we're trying to get their money, although that's very important, but because we have an interest in the same things. We want to do the same things together. They have the same missions we do. This is what we want to, and we cannot fund our missions without their support. And getting their support also means, first and foremost, understanding where they are, who they are, what's important to them. So there's another last thing I promise, and then no more stats. And that's that we all talk about how, as we just saw on that pie chart, there's all this money in philanthropy in the United States. And it's absolutely true. We hit a $390 billion mark last year. It's just extraordinary. And chances are, when these new numbers come out in about a month or so, that that number will be higher. Maybe it'll crack $400 billion. That would be great, wouldn't it? But there's another thing. There's a countervailing force. And that is that we've seen the number of donors decline. So we have more money from fewer people. Why is that happening? Well, again, it's happening because of the wealthiest people in America are giving more money. So while the media tends to describe this in terms of wealthy people, high earners, being relatively, miserly, might be a way to describe it. In fact, one study done by Paul Shervish a number of years ago, when he was doing all that work with Boston College and figuring the wealth transfer, was that the giving by the top 1% may be as much as 4 to 5 times that of everyone else on an annual basis in comparison to income. About 8% of their against their income on an annual basis. So there's a lot going on at the very top, and that's fortunate for us because we're also seeing the decline in charity in general, both in terms of the numbers of people who give and the amounts that they are giving. Now, okay, so the reason you're here is not for all that, but I still hope that's useful. This is a picture of fish because I really want to confuse you. I started with pie, now I'm moving my way to the main course. This is really to show you something that I started in the field of philanthropy. My wife and I, she's from Japan, we wanted to form a little group to get together and talk about Japan because that was of interest to us, and we wanted to eat good Japanese food and hang out with other people who were interested in the same things. We called this thing the Sushi Club. And we did this once a month, and at the time, this was back in the days of mail. You may remember mail from the post office. You'd put a stamp on an envelope, things like this, back in the old days. So we had a mailing list that started with 6 people who were interested in this and mushroomed to 150 people in the space of 3 months. This is how many people were interested in the same obscure thing, which is eating fish, talking about Japan. Now, it was kind of a hot time to talk about that topic, but the real thing that I'm pointing out here is there was a group of people who cared about the same stuff. It's just a matter of finding them. Well, often people find one another. That's prospecting 1.0. It's using our own human networks to make that happen. And what was most important to me as a young fundraiser at the time about that is I could, by having a personal relationship with other people interested in the same things, they would open up and share tremendous amounts of information with me. So if I went over to a book at the Foundation Center, I could only find this slim little volume, about 100 pages, from translated from the Japanese Foundation Center. That book isn't even produced anymore in English. But the Japanese version of the book I knew was at least 4 times the size. So what were we missing? Well, I was never going to find out, not in terms of print, not in the Foundation Center, as great as they are, and they're terrific. I had to learn about it through colleagues. So where's your sushi? Where's your network of people? We're going to tell you what you need to know. This is prospecting 1.0. And as we get into 2.0 and 3.0, I want to just encourage you never to discount 1.0. We are all in a little community right now by virtue of being on this call. If you can tolerate me for more than an hour, then that means that I'm now your newest contact source for information on research. And the same thing for you. There may be something you know that'd be great for me to learn from you. Let's make sure we keep these channels open. if you do nothing else after this call, let's connect with one another on LinkedIn. Because to fail to do so inhibits us in two ways. It inhibits our ability to learn from one another when we need that information to make something work in fundraising, to advance our institutions. But it also inhibits our own personal growth professionally. 4 out of 5 recruiters use LinkedIn as its first and sometimes its only source to identify candidates for positions. If you're not on LinkedIn, you need to be there. And if you're on LinkedIn only in a passive way, it's sort of like building your database but not prospecting. It's useful not to just link up to anybody out there, but for contexts like these where we meet one another, have an interest in the same things, let's utilize these social networks in the same way we've used traditional networks to expand our influence, help one another, and then enable ourselves to do better work for our institutions. And that's exactly what I did here. So what I would do with a sushi club is I'd have these great friendships I'd make. And then if there was a project, as there were projects like needing to fund a program where we brought artwork from the former Yugoslavia, where there was a lot of rivalry between different factions, as you may recall historically, I would want to be able to go and contact the Department of Commerce and call the desk officer and say, hey, what are the companies working here locally? Which companies are involved in the United States that are from Serbia or Croatia or, you know, Montenegro? And I could ask those questions and they could tell me exactly where I could get a list. Or I might, if it was something about a new person coming from Sumitomo Corporation in Japan, I might be able to talk to the person who's with Sumitomo who I'd met over sushi and is also on the Japan-US Chamber and ask that person about, well, who's coming in next? And they would just pour open the floodgates of information that they were coming from Tokyo by way of New York, and that they were going to be in, they had been in New York for 2 years, then returned to Tokyo for 2 years, now they were coming to Washington, what their role was, and then everything else you never needed to know, what their wife's name was, how many children, what the fact they were going to live in Bethesda, how they needed to rent a car, and did you know where the best school was? Once that connection is made, people will tell you virtually everything. And if we honor their trust, then it's really instrumental in terms of raising money. So I use this information not only to better understand where the opportunities were and find new ones, but also it led me to situations where they would invite me to their offices in order to present a check for the institution simply because we had that personal contact. So the personal network is invaluable, but there are limits, geographic limits, limits of our knowledge, and certainly at that time, limits of technology to find those people. So that's where we get to prospecting 2.0, what we do today. And I'm going to give you some ground rules for successful digital prospecting. Now, I know that I am going fast as lightning and it's only going to get faster. So I'm going to look quickly and see if there's anything that you have there. You haven't posted any questions yet. That's fine. But if you have any questions or comments along the path, I'm going to keep an eye out for those. So feel free to post them. And if you don't have any right now, that's fine too. There'll be plenty of time towards the end. Now, let me jump right back in. This is a little game I like to call Pedestal Man. So I don't know if you can actually do this while we're doing a webinar, but it might be a fun game to play inside the office. So we all know Hangman, right? That's where you make a bunch of spaces for letters. And then you have to have somebody else guess the letters. And if they get the letter right, you write the letter down. If they get the letter wrong, well, then you draw part of a body. And soon enough, you know, if you've missed the requisite numbers, like one for the head, the body, the arms and legs, I guess that's 6 together. Well, now you've played hangman and you've lost the game and executed someone in the process. And I thought that was a pretty grim thing to do in fundraising. So instead I invented Pedestal Man. So it's the reverse, which is where you've got a pedestal with 6 characteristics on the bottom. And what you want to do is figure out the 6 things that you'd really like to know about somebody before you meet them. So I will ask you this in the form of a question. What are the 6 things, or any things, you don't have to write 6, what's something you'd really like to know about somebody before you meet them? Something you might use as a qualification tool for knowing that the person might be interested or really have the financial ability to help you. What would you like to know about a donor? Go ahead and list it. So I'm going to read them out. So Scott says their passion. Yeah, absolutely. I love that. Philanthropic priorities from Nancy. Yes. Job, education, background. Thank you, Robin. Absolutely. Employment, Jason. Yes, absolutely. Let me see, what are their interests? From Lisa, assets, Donna, board affection, affiliations, not affections, but hopefully that too. Personal connections, where do you want to, I can't see the rest of that one. Be remembered, absolutely. Where they live, volunteer experience, connection to the organization, faith, background, family, are they married, kids? What do they do in their spare time? These are all good things to know. and we have others coming in too, like religious affiliation, past giving, success stories. I would argue two things before I put up this next slide. One is that it's really good to do this internal inventory. The reason is because what is important to your institution, and maybe even to you within your institution, is very important to clarify, to codify, and to write down. Because we can keep adjusting it and making it new, but we do want to be aware of what we're looking for and also what our biases are. And the other reason is because your profile within your institution may be different from every other institution. For example, religious affiliation, which is something we won't be talking about how to get online today, because that's not something you can that people are listing. There are some things that might indicate it, but those are difficult to do, and it's kind of treacherous areas like looking at race or ethnicity. But it may be very important within your institution to know about religious affiliation, and there may be proxies for that information. But to another institution, that's completely irrelevant. So first of all, come up with your own definition of what constitutes your prospect, the smiling face on top of your pedestal. Again, you can change it over time, but know what you're looking for, and then it's much easier to find it. But I'm going to show you six things that I think that you can actually look for, that you can find, and that I think will be enormously helpful to qualifying opportunities. And these can be used both for prospecting as well as for researching. And I'll describe what I mean by the difference there. Prospecting meaning you're looking for more people, right? And qualifying or researching to make sure that, you know, you understand who these people are a little bit before you go and visit with them. And I know it seems like an obvious difference, but they are different things. So here are my big five plus one I'll share with you in a second. Stock, real estate, and business. And those are more financial characteristics, if you think about it. And then philanthropy, political, and affinity. That's in the big black space there. So my apologies for rolling off the side of the pedestal. It's not meant to. That's extremely important. And many of you alluded to that in your own answers. And the last one we got here from Shiva was capacity and inclination. And that kind of summarizes what I've got on the pedestal. So what I've got with capacity or financial ability would be the stock, the real estate, and the business, which for most people comprise about 75% of the financial pot. And then for the other characteristics, philanthropy, political, giving, and for their affinity to you, which is demonstrated in different ways. They might be volunteers. They might be people who have, attended events. They might be people who, you know, lots of different things that might indicate their interest in you. Those things go more to their heart. So we're trying to look at it. Yes.
Jay, so can I ask you to clarify business? Are you talking about like what they earn in business or a share of a business, which it might be different from stock on the stock market? What?
Right. It's really about the business they own as opposed to what they're earning, because I'm thinking here about assets as opposed to the income. Absolutely. And in fact, I'm going to show you examples of each right now.
Great.
Okay, so now here are the five factors as this company Donor Search. Brian, you were saying to everybody that that's one of the companies I work with. They have a tremendous amount of giving data, and they also have a lot of data on organizations because they have a lot of clients, I think 2,700. But they've done a study looking at about 400 client databases just internally, anonymizing the data, but to get a sense about what are the common characteristics for people who give a lot of money. And so those things are pretty much what's on the bottom of my pyramid, the kinds of things we're discussing. Giving to your organization, giving to other organizations, political giving, foundation organization position, value of real estate. And they also do include now this other thing, which is about business ownership. So I'm going to just go through each of those and show us where you can find it. First thing is the giving to you. And one way to get at that is not just to look at the last gift, and maybe not even just to look at cumulative giving, but maybe to do an analysis that might be described as an RFM analysis, which is a relatively concrete and simple process for finding out their recency, their frequency, and their cumulative giving or money. And you can do that by maybe even just having a 1 to 5 scale, something like that, or 1 to 10 on each of these characteristics, dividing your database accordingly. Like if people have given in the last 6 months, they get a 5. If they gave in, you know, 6 months or to a 12 months pass, it's a four, et cetera. You pick the numbers and apply them, but it's simply a way to code your database looking at these essential characteristics of how recently they've supported you, how frequently they support you, and how much money they've given to you historically. That's one way to get a handle on where your top priorities are and to prospect within your database, giving to you. But also giving to others is really key. And I'll show you a couple places where you can get that data in just a couple of minutes. And why is it important? I'll just read the top bullet, which is that gift, or maybe the bottom one's better. Individuals who have made a gift of over $100,000 to a nonprofit are 32 times more likely to make a charitable donation elsewhere. This is really important. If they're giving more, they're not just more, of course they have money. They're not just likely to have money. If they didn't have money, they couldn't give it away. But if they're giving more money, they're also more likely to be giving to more places. And I think the recent stats I saw from U.S. Trust indicate that major donors, people give $100,000 or above in a single donation, they give on average to 7 or 8 organizations a year. So I'm not saying they give the same amount to all of them. They clearly do not. Some give a lot more, some give less. These are averages. But the main point is most people don't put all their money into one place. So first of all, that means that they're going to divide whatever you think that they might have available to them in terms of their giving. But it also means there's an opportunity for your organization. Because simply because they give to someone down the street doesn't mean they won't give to you. It's just a matter of whether we understand them well enough. And to understand them, we have to know them. And these people may not be in your database at all, but they may be giving to similar causes. So I'll show you where to get that information momentarily. Board and trustee positions are really important because if we're doing our work right as organizations, and most of us try to do that, we try to bring people onto our boards who have resources and networks and who give. So those people are, again, if you find a person who's serving on a board in a trustee role, then that would be, again, a good indicator for your prospecting work. Political giving may seem counterintuitive. Political gifts are usually relatively small, and in fact, they're capped in most places, especially to federal campaigns, $2,500. So in so much as that, you may look at a person who's given $100 or $500 or $1,000 and think that's not really indicative of their ability to give us $10,000 or $100,000. But in fact, the number of people who give at that level is very small in political giving, and very few people really give at all. So as you can see right in the middle here, a single gift of $1,000 puts your constituent in the top 0.1% of potential donors to you. So this is a really important thing. You're looking for people who give politically, and the more they've given, which would be cumulative in this case, the more likely they are to be making major gifts. Now, and there's something else that's not here, but I've seen in two adjacent studies, and that's that the people that political donors are giving as much as 70% of our revenue to us. So if you were to go and just do a screening, which I'll show you how to do later, and screen your database, which is where you provide it to a third party vendor and they bring back results to you. And then you looked at your political donors who are also donors to you. You'd likely find that those people are making the lion's share of the philanthropic revenue is coming from people who are also making political donations. It's fascinating because it's not about which party. It's not about whether it's Congress or for local. It's merely the act of making these donations. They're engaged. So this is a really important thing to consider. And then, oops, I don't know what that's about. Sorry about that, folks. I guess Microsoft didn't like what I was doing. There we go. And then value of real estate. Real estate data is available on about 64-65% of the population because that's roughly the percentage of adults who have their name on a title to property, whether or not they have a mortgage. Their names are associated with a property. So a lot of people with property doesn't mean a lot of people with money because most of us do have a mortgage. However, real estate is valuable in several ways. It does provide an indicator. It is useful to know because some people can make a gift of real estate, and especially for those who have multiple properties and those who don't have children. But if you find people with $2 million or more in the value of real estate, as much as it seems like everybody has a property like that $3 million house in Cupertino, it's actually relatively rare. I think it's only about 2%, 3% of U.S. housing stock now that's at $1 million. So all that we're hearing about all these extraordinary properties, the reason why it's so important to, you know, in the news is because it's newsworthy, which in other words means it doesn't happen to the rest of us. It's more exceptional. So now if you're living in Manhattan, there's a lot more properties of $1 million, but there are also people living in Manhattan who do not live in $1 million properties. And this is true around the country. So I would just say real estate, again, is something that is something information you can gain access to, information you can probe for both prospecting and to research your donors. And it's also a really, really positive indicator at the upper end.
Jay?
And then my, yes, go ahead.
Two questions. One is, I basically, I'll often use Zillow to find out what a property is worth where someone
yep.
lives. Of course, you don't know how much is mortgaged or not. What are the other sources for real estate, and what are the sources for political donations? That's a question from Leticia.
And Leticia, I'm going to, in fact, show you, not only tell you, but show you right now. And I'll start with the stock to answer that question, because I have these slides first, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Stock is the most narrow piece. It's the piece that's going to be least evident in your database or anybody else's database. But this is what I'll say about this. 1% of your database is likely made up of insiders in the stock market. So the reason why I have this slide here is that even though it's not on the volume of insiders is going to be very low, the people who have stock at that level are going to be really important. And then it goes down, it's kind of the opposite for real estate. So now I'll take you through each of these and show you exactly where you can get that information. And I'll start with the stock just because it's so obscure. Again, the reason for this importance of this goes back to the Giving USA data. When the stock market goes up, so does giving. When the stock market goes down, so does giving. And the giving is a lagging indicator of the stock market. So these people, I'm going to just tell you quickly, the insiders, in case you don't know who they are, these are people who have a policymaking role at a public company, directors of a public company. These are companies that issue stock and then we buy stock in. 10% owners of any public company, or people who are have the founder's stock, the stock that's originally distributed when companies go public. And there's a lot of information on these people. You'll see all this in the slides that we distribute later. And in fact, I'm going to show you an example of it right now. And this also goes to the heart of where do you get this data and what does it look like? So this is one place where you can look for it. And I pull up Blackbaud just because I figured a few of you out there use Blackbaud. It's not to advertise Blackbaud, but it's a good company. And Blackbaud offers a number of different software packages, including Razor's Edge. And it's fairly common. So I thought it'd be fun to look at them. This is their stock going back to 2004 to today. So you can see that even though the stock market's dropped a little bit for all of us just recently, they're doing well. And that's one of the main reasons I wanted to show you this. This comes from, as you can see in the upper left corner, from CNBC. And so if you go to CNBC.com, when you're done, you can look this up and you'll see any company you want to look up. You can look it up in plain English or you can put in the ticker. And then you'll see how the company's doing. Then if you were to look down the page, you'd also see about where they're operating and who are their major investors, institutional investors, et cetera. And then if you were to click on the thing right there where you see it says in red up at the top, holding summary, and right next to it, insider holdings, if you were to click that, you'd see a list of the insider activity, all transactions for the insiders in Blackbaud, because Blackbaud's a public company. You can only do this with public companies, not privates. I'll show you the private information, as Brian was talking about, just a second. So this would show you about where they are, and you can sort any of these columns. I can't sort this because it's a slide, but you would be able to click this and pull up all the people and buy their holdings. Now, what if you wanted to get into more detail? Well, let's say what you did was somebody told you, you know, I think we have somebody who's involved in Apple around here. So can you find out anything about Apple and about their insiders? Well, you could go to the SEC, which is the SEC.gov, and that's what it looks like today. And then if you were to click on that, you'd see the Edgar search tools are available, and you could go right there and click on editor search tools, company or fund name. And then you could plug in the name. So there's Apple. I just typed it in. And then you would hit search and boom, there are all the things that have Apple in their name. Well, I was interested in the same place that had that nice building. So I clicked on Apple Inc. You can see that it's right there underlined. And then you'd see a whole list of documents. We could spend a whole day on what these documents are about. So I'm going to tell you the simplest way. This is research for lazy people like me. I would want to go to what's called a DEF 14A, which simply is a reference to a proxy statement. That's the document that comes out so people can vote on who they want on the board and provides a lot of financial data. And it's fair, it comes out on an annual basis. So the DEF 14A, I would click on that and then it would pull up a lot of information. And the way I deal with this is the simple, command F or control F, whatever is on your keyboard, to find what I'm looking for. So I decided to look up Tim Cook, and there's his bio in his photo and where he serves and on what boards. And then I would want to look up compensation, and I could see all the compensation by this year, last year, the year before, his salaries, bonuses, stock awards, non-equity incentive plan compensation, all other compensation. Now, you could spend a lot of time on this, or you could do it like this. So I want to tell you now that even though you can tell I'm a fast talker, I'm not always a fast thinker, but I looked all that up before our presentation today in the space of 10 minutes. So everything that I just showed you, you can do in 10 to 15 minutes. Now, what about private businesses? Private businesses are different. First of all, there are a lot of them, right? There are only about 12,000 public companies, but now it may be verging on 30 million private businesses. But very few generate a lot of money. Or in other words, back to your point, Brian, there are very few people who have a lot of wealth as a result of their private business, and certainly fewer of those who are going to be able to just give that money because it's locked up in the company. In fact, there are under 200,000, or about 3.3% of all the private businesses that are grossing over 10 million. So if I were thinking about prospecting, I'd be looking for companies that gross over 10 million. So where are you going to find that kind of information? Well, first of all, this information is not public, but it is often provided, especially to Open Corporates is one source that I know Donor Search uses that I just started looking at. There's one called Manta, but it's a little spotty. And then there's the big one, D&B, Dun & Bradstreet. That can be expensive, but you could probably access it at your local library or your university library. There's also Hoover's, which is a subset of D&B. It's owned by the company. And the thing I think is nice about that for our conversation is it means it's by definition a subset of the top companies. So if you're looking for that for private company owners, you can look there. And then you can also look, of course, at their own websites and the local and regional media, like the Inc. List, which will tell you who the fastest growing companies are in your area. And then real estate. Finally, I got to your real estate, Brian. So here I do use Zillow a lot. And there are other sources like Trulia, LexisNexis, and one that I think is really great is KnowX. That's KNOWX. You can see it in my last bullet here. So what is that? That's a source that's derived from LexisNexis, which lets you look up assets. It's only $59 a month. You can go month to month, so you don't have to keep using it every month. And unlike Zillow, where you can only look up a one property and not by the person's name, in KnowX, you can look up something by the person's name or by the property address, and it'll list other properties owned by that person and also provide other information such as plane ownership, boat ownership, spousal names, children's names, and the assessed values. So KnowX is the source that I use. But if you don't have any of that or don't want to use any of that, Zillow is terrific. It provides an estimate of value. Other resources, political giving, charitable, and foundation boards. This is political giving right here. You can get from opensecrets.org. It's free, like Zillow is free, and most of the other things I'm talking about are free, all the SEC data. So this is something really fun. Go and check this out after the session today. You can jump right on and look up the name of a person, look up a zip code, and provide a lot of information on that, and you'll see it all there. And I'm getting a note here that KnowX is no longer, they were purchased by LexisNexis. Actually, Don, they have been owned by LexisNexis for quite a while. If they've shut down that portal, I apologize. I used them as late as last year, but maybe they're gone now. But they have been part of LexisNexis for some time. But I'll check into that afterwards. But do take a look for it. If it's no longer there, contact LexisNexis and see if they have something that's not Universe for Development Professionals, which would be a very expensive alternative if you're a shop that has the capacity to spend that kind of money. I'm trying to provide you some windows on products that are less expensive in this seminar, but I'm happy to also talk about other kinds of things, including things that are beautiful but also quite expensive offline. In this case, opensecrets.org, again, is free, and you can look this up to your heart's content. Very useful information. Then the next one here is from Donor Search. You can also look at NOSA, but this is a free tool that Donor Search offers, so it's a lot of fun. So keep note of this. It's called dsgiving.com. Again, dsgiving.com. You can see that right at the top there where I've put that in. And that will allow you to look up any name of any person that they might have in their database, which now has well over 100 million records of gifts. And pretty interesting stuff. But the main reason I'm putting this up here is because it's free. So if you're trying to taste test what kind of data is available to you on giving, check that out. This is from Foundation Directory. And Foundation Directory Online is a great resource. There is kind of a free interface on the front of the Foundation Center website. And of course, you can go into the Foundation Center physically or one of their regional libraries if you have access to that. But this is not a bad thing. I can't remember. I think it's still at about $49.99 a month for this. And it's a terrific resource that lets you pull up a whole bunch of data, ranging from who's sitting on the board of these foundations, to go back to my point about what's a key indicator, all the way through to show me all the grant makers in the state of wherever who give in this kind of, to this kind of activity, and it would pull it all up for you. It's very handy, very clean, very efficient. And you can see I did an example of that right here where you can look up human services in Wisconsin, and then it would pull up a list of all the potential grant makers, which in that case is huge. I mean, it's 2,111 from that one search. Now, I'm going to touch on social media quickly because that seems to be the place that, at least in the past, research didn't really go. And it's a tremendous treasure trove of data, especially about how people feel as opposed to what money they have. So the gift pyramid on the left is just, again, to illustrate what we all know. If you go to the top, those people tend to give the majority of the money in a campaign. So whether or not you're in a campaign, of course, we're looking for people with passion for our work and with resources to give to it. We're looking for that top group. Similar in terms of social networks, where there's something called a long tail phenomenon, which is where at the very top, those people have the greatest amount of activity. It's a very small pool of people. And then a lot of other people following them, including lots of users who almost never post or post rarely. So what you're really looking for is people with a lot of social capital here. There has not been, to my knowledge, a study interlacing social capital and financial capital. However, when it comes to big campaigns, knowing who your ambassadors can be very valuable, and it's driving a lot of the successful campaigns for Giving Tuesday at universities. So rather than just putting up a page and saying we're having our giving day and hoping for the best, you can really work with your social ambassadors, people who have great followings, who post and have a lot of engagement. Find those people on your followers lists, within your Facebook community, and then entice them, invite them, plead with them to be your best advocates and ambassadors. And you can find them by using something like Clout, which is free, K-L-O-U-T, or you can use a tool I'm going to show you in a second that will enable you to do the kind of thing that the University of Michigan has done, which I think now crests over $6 million a year. And it's basically going and finding the people with great social followings and inviting them to participate in your work. So that brings us to 3.0. And as we come, I know I'm going fast here and also getting close to the hour, but this is where you can do some massive work, where you can go to third-party vendors and say, I don't want to just look up everything. I don't want to just hunt around in the internet. Those are all good things to do, but they can take a lot of time. Rather, this is where you can go to another party and say, either I need a lot of people who look like this or will help us, or I'd like to take my database and I'd like to find the people who can help us within it. And I would say that the latter, it may be the most important thing you ever do. I'm going to show you why in a second. But first, I want to address the desire we all naturally have, which is to find new people, because I know that's that's probably what you want to do too. So here are three things you could use. And one is Axiom Personics. That's a service of Axiom. And now I'll allude to Worth Magazine. Some of you may know it. It's a magazine that's aimed at people who have over $2 million in net worth. And Worth Magazine, in fact, has a different kind of subscription model from the one they used to. They send it directly to households they think would be interested in the magazine rather than having people subscribe to it. And it's a great magazine, by the way. Lots of talk about philanthropy. But the way they got the list was they went to Axiom and they developed a list of all the people who were like that. And so the worth list is made up of people who are, again, $2 million or above. And 95% of these people are philanthropic. 95%, which is, by the way, higher than either the general population or even the population of the one percenters in the United States by 20%. So it's enormous. And now you can't go to Axiom and buy a list of Personics. You can do that. You can't go to Axiom Personics and say, give me the worth list, because they won't sell you the worth list. That's theirs. But you can go to Axiom Personics and say, I'd like a list of all the people who are philanthropic, who live in these areas and have over $2 million net worth. Essentially, you're asking for the worth list. And that's something that's very inexpensive. And they can either email to you there for you on their behalf, or you can work out some kind of arrangement. CQ Roll Call does something quite different. Roll Call is something that may be known to you as a publication in D.C. They talk to political circles, but on a national basis, they also do a lot with headers and ads on websites. And what they do is they tailor what content is presented to us in terms of advertising to the searches that are conducted against top sites. So not just every old site, but the best 6,000 sites. And so if you wanted to do something like one of my clients is doing, where they said, we want to know all the people who might be interested in giving during Ramadan, because that's essential for Muslims to give during Ramadan, and they give 2.5% of their annual income, 2.5% of their assets on an annualized basis to charity, they want to know where to give. And so they might want to go and look that up somewhere and just look up Zakat or Ramadan or giving. Well, I would love to have an ad for my organization appear in front of the person who is doing that search. And that's what CQ Roll Call does. And then finally, Donor Search Marketing List. I'll just show you a copy of that. It looks like this, where you can go in and you can do searches according to giving criteria, such as housing and shelter. And you'd narrow their database of 167 million people down to 451,000 records. And you can purchase that and only that. And it's at pennies per name. Finally, there's screenings. I told you I'd share something about where you can find new people, but I also think there are people who love you right now residing in your database and they're not giving it an optimal level. And the only reason is because we have not asked them. So there are lots of ways to do this, ranging from peer screenings, which is where we sit down with a group of board members and friends and ask them what they know about people, data overlays, such as show me all the people who are different ages or zip codes, or there's assets. And that's really what we were talking about now. So there are a bunch of asset screenings out there. I'm going to tell you who does it. Those companies, in fact, I'll give you a list in a second, but the major ones in the United States, in no particular order, are Target Analytics, Grenzebach Glear, iWave, Wealth Engine, and Donor Search. I may have, in fact, done that in reverse alphabetical order. I'm not sure. But they should all do something like what you're seeing on your screen right now, which is you can give them a selection of names, and they'll screen it for free and give you all the results and give you access to their database for a period of time. So what they've done for me right here is they've come up with a silly-looking page. So you can go to donorsearch.net, special offer for friends of Jay Frost, because I host their series of webinars, and you can go ahead and gain access to their database for a month, and you can run a free screening. So if any of this stuff interests you even mildly, I would strongly encourage you to do this, and with all the other companies too, because it's the quickest way of finding in a hurry who has the money and who's giving, and that's the focus of this company. So I would say, again, if you're interested in that, go to each and every one of the companies. In fact, here are all the companies. You'll see it when you get your slide deck. And these also include, in case you're far away and I didn't know where you were, let's say you're outside the United States, it includes all the global screening companies. So hold on to this list because it's not an easy one to get. But you can see the U.S. companies that do this work embedded within it. Now, why is this important? This is just a little on finding your social ambassadors, too. I have that there. The reason why this is important is summed up in this picture. I used to deliver a lot of screening results when I owned a screening company. And one of the things I did was go to one of the IVs. And I brought all this information. I started showing to the institution, to a big room of people, at least this big, and that many development officers. So a very sophisticated place raising a lot of money. And I was showing them a list in descending order from the richest person to the least wealthy in terms of securities holdings only, the most public of the public data, who was there. And as I showed them the list, their faces were blank. And I thought that maybe I had done something wrong or that we were looking at the wrong list. I didn't know what was happening. And it took me a little while to realize the reason why their faces had this expression is because they were processing the fact that they did not recognize anyone after the first 50 names. This was clearly one of the smartest groups of people I've ever worked with. Everyone in the room was a lot smarter than me. They just didn't know that these people had money, went to the same school, and cared about the same things. So if you can do nothing else but just test one of these screening products, I hope you'll do it. It's a really, really fun thing to do. And look at from another way, this is a picture from the Occupy protests in New York a number of years ago now. But I've never forgotten this picture, this woman holding this sign up, because it's a lot like those first pictures I showed you when we started, which is to say, you cannot judge people by how they look. If she weren't holding this sign up, you wouldn't necessarily know she's one of these people who's got millions of dollars at birth. And she's just as eager to make the world a better place as anybody else. In fact, if she was willing to spend a few days in Zuccotti Park, maybe a little more eager. And so I think our real purpose in all this is to find those people and to help them to help us to do the thing we both want to do together. So hopefully some of this information is helpful to you. I know it went a little long here. I'm happy to stick around and answer some questions. Certainly happy to talk to you offline as well.
Jay, thank you so much. There are a few questions that came in, so if you could hang with us a few more minutes, great. For those of you who have to go, you can listen to the recording. Two clarifications on one on donor search. Is there an expiration date for that free trial?
No.
Okay. Nope. We will make sure to give that link in our follow-up email tomorrow. Andrea was asking whether the screenings you're talking about, are they done by names that they provide of their lists? Do the organizations provide the names, or are those names that are grabbed from the screening companies?
There are a couple ways that you can do this kind of work, but the screening I described was where you would provide the names. So you'd have a group of names and addresses. You'd provide them to DonorSearch or one of these other companies or multiple companies, and they would review them against their databases. They all use between 2 and 3 dozen databases, and then they would bring back all the results to you. Now, there's also a way, though, Andrea, that where you can use some of these products, like the one I showed you from DonorSearch, where you can generate a prospecting list. That's like what we would have done in direct mail houses in the past, and just say, well, how many people do you have in the state of Wisconsin or something who are interested in the arts? And that's a different kind of tool. So you can do both, but the screening I was mentioning has to do with your own file.
Great. And is that the one that's generally free at these various companies, the one where you give them your names and they'll take a small subset of them and give you the information for free as a way of building an affinity with you? Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
And in fact, just one more thing about that, which is that I would encourage people to go ahead. If this is really of interest to you, then see if they'll run your whole file. I mean, if you're really serious about doing a screening, if you're doing it just for fun, then do that anyway. But if you really are interested in comparing companies or seeing if you have enough to merit the investment, because it does cost you a few thousand dollars to buy a full screening, then I would say see if they'll run the whole file. I'm pretty sure DonorSearch would if they know you're serious. These other companies should be willing to do so. I always did when I owned a screening company. It's the best way to get a measure of whether there's enough potential to merit your investment.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Would you, I don't know if you can do this, someone's asked whether you would say what you think the best the best prospect search engine is for the money? What's the best value for the money? Can you do that or no?
Yeah, no, I can do that. I mean, we all have our own biases, so you know, just take whatever I say with a grain of salt. But I think all of them are great. I really do. But they all are very different in terms of what they what is underneath the hood. It's sort of, and I don't know much about cars, so now I'm getting into really dangerous territory. But I understand that if you were to lift your hood and actually look at the engine, that those engines are very different from one another. But for most of us, or people like me anyway, I get in the car, and as long as I can drive there, I'm happy. So the real question is, there are two pieces. One is the look and feel. Another one is durability. And then the third one is, you know, kind of processing power. And so for the last one, the processing power has to do with what data they utilize. And the data is substantially different. So there are two reasons why I'm three reasons I'm really affiliated with Donor Search personally. The first is because the founder and I go way back. We were together at Wealth Engine. We both left at the same time. We've known each other a long time, and I trust him. I really like him as a person. But also what they built is on the back of the giving data. And I have to say, because I spent so much of my time with wealth data, initially I was skeptical about that, but I'm not anymore. I'm completely convinced, because if you don't have a lot of giving data, then you will inevitably miss somebody. You know, you could find a person who's wealthy and not giving, or you could find a person who's giving and not wealthy. And the only way to be able to look at both of those characteristics is to look at them in tandem. And there are only two companies that do that well. One is Target Analytics at Blackbaud, which has a very large giving database as well, and then Donor Search. I believe that in terms of price, Donor Search is less money, but I wouldn't make the choice on that basis. I would look at how you like the company, how you like all the data that's presented, and what they're trying to sell you. And so that's the third reason I tend to work with Donor Search, because at least in the past, Blackbaud, which has a terrific suite of companies and everything to do is great, but they would really try to get people to buy modeling data. And there's a value to that. But I believe the value to modeling has to do with large databases to find generally where to go 70% of the time and be right 70% of the time. It's about direct marketing, not about individuals. And if you use a filter of general demographic information to find out who's got a lot of money, you're going to miss some of those people. It'll be like that room I showed you at the Ivy League University. It's too easy to miss the top 1% if you're looking at everybody in deciles or quintiles. So I believe modeling data is great, but if it's used as a filter, it's a mistake. And so that's one of the reasons I've worked with Donor Search. But I would say this, even if you'd never heard me, I would still be the first one to say, look at every company. And I would say price is the least important characteristic. And the reason I say that is because anybody you find is going to enable you to raise a lot of money if you can get your team to go out, pick up the phone, and build a relationship. And everything we've talked about today is ultimately about that. Finding people who care about the same stuff, but actually have the resources to make it happen. These are tools to make that process faster. If you find a tool set that enables you to do that faster and get your team out the door, then we all win, the donors, us, and our missions.
Jay, this has been incredible. We have a lot of people typing in saying how incredibly useful this has been, how timely this has been. You have shared so much amazing data. And what I really like is a lot of it is free stuff, because most organizations in the nonprofit world are small. Most of the organizations on today are on the smaller size. And getting free information is really important for us, because even $59 or $100 a month can be challenging, though of course you have to spend to make, and we know that too. But this has been such an incredible overview with great details, and you've really helped the field today. So I thank you so much for being with us. Thank you all for joining, and we'll get all this information out to you by tomorrow with all of these different links, and best of luck to you in your fundraising. And Jay, thank you. And everyone, have a great afternoon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.